Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to talk about the physics behind what-if disaster scenarios, like if you stepped into a particle accelerator or if your airplane window popped off. What would happen? Call us if you have a disaster. What if? Do you have one? What if you've ever wondered about? Well, we'll try to crunch the numbers. Our number, 844-724-8255. Also, tweet us at SciFry. But first, this week, President Trump signed an executive order that would dismantle the Clean Power Plan, a key part of the Obama administration's strategy for addressing climate change. The policy changes from the White House also roll back other parts of Obama's climate change efforts, all politically aimed at reviving coal industry jobs and promoting energy independence. Here to talk about those changes and selected short subjects in science is Rachel Feldman, science editor at Popular Science. Good to see you back again, Rachel.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
Let's talk about how big of an effect does this new executive order really have?
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, all of these plans have already been put in motion. And the truth is that it's not actually in our best interest economically to roll them back. You know, we're pushing towards having clean energy, which is more viable in the long term, even if you don't care about the health effects of emissions or the reality of ever worsening climate change. You know, there's no future in fossil fuel. It's going to run out. And, you know, the president talks about decreasing our dependence on foreign energy, which is great, but we can do that by pursuing renewable energy. And he also talks about increasing jobs, but it's really a false narrative. There are no new jobs to be got in the coal industry. They were in renewable energy. So the truth is, it's likely that the companies actually won't take as much advantage of this as they could, but it's still not great. We were supposed to lower our carbon emissions from power use by 32% by 2030. And, you know, we're going to lose progress on that for sure.
Yeah. This comes at the same week that there's new information about climate change and human health.
Yeah. So a few days ago, this new medical consortium launched this really large group of doctors coming out just to say it's time for us to address the health effects of climate change because there are a lot of them. Another study came out this week looking at the effects on mental health of climate change, both acute effects after disasters that are happening more often because of climate change and the long term effects of, you know, seeing the natural world degrade in front of you. So it's not good for humanity.
especially now with a lot of other stressors.
Yes. Happening. So it's a stressful time.
So they actually come up with numbers to show how it would affect people?
Yeah. You know, they were looking at kind of a meta-analysis of all the research out there just to highlight and draw attention to the problems that are cropping up more and more often. There was another study this week that looked at air pollution specifically and found that it kills 3.5 million people a year.
Of climate change because there are a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Another study came out this week looking at
and President has he pointed to these numbers at all? But no, I guess not. Yeah. So have these figures gotten any traction in the science community?
Yeah, well, you know, for scientists, it's really not a surprise. We already know that carbon emissions contribute to climate change. We already know that climate change is immediately harmful and harmful in the long term to humans. We know that having particulate matter from coal power plants in the air is not good for human health. So, you know, for scientists, this really isn't news. They're just really trying to get politicians to listen.
Okay, let's change directions a little bit and get into something a little less stressful. you have a story about this week, out this week, about electric sand.
Right. So it's Titan, which is a moon of Saturn that's considered the most Earth-like world we've ever seen. It has these methane oceans. It has this thick atmosphere. It's a very cool little world. And scientists decided to take a couple of hydrocarbons that have been detected there and subject them to the pressure that we know probably exists on the moon. So basically, they found how sand would probably act on Titan. And they found that it's very electrically charged, so it probably sticks together very well. So you can imagine these sandcastles and dunes forming and staying that way for weeks, which might just sound kind of goofy, but it would be important if we ever tried to send a lander there.
Yeah.
The scientists said that anything that landed on Titan, it would be like putting a cat into a box full of packing peanuts.
Oh,
it
my
would,
goodness.
It would just be completely stuck. Yeah. So it is actually something that scientists would have to think about if they wanted to put a probe on Titan.
You put that on the list. there's a lot of work in simulating human biology on a chip, you write, to be able to test drugs and procedures. And now there's a new kind of chip?
Yes. So the idea of an organ on a chip is that you kind of take cells from a particular organ and see how much you can make them act like that actual organ system in a lab. Because the better job you can do of testing drugs inside a petri dish, the more likely you are to know what the outcome is going to be before you do the human trials. And this is the first time that scientists have put together all of the organs that go into the menstrual cycle into one petri dish and, made it function. So, they had cells from ovaries, fallopian tubes, the cervix, the uterus. And so basically when they have this system, they can test different drugs and see how the 28-day hormonal cycle would, change the behavior of the drugs, how it would, change the interaction between different organs. So it's just like part of a movement to finally start looking at how drugs work in someone who's not biologically male.
So they have a petri dish going through a menstrual cycle? Is that what happens?
At the hormonal level, yes.
That's terrific. And last, now we know how to turn a spinach leaf into a heart.
Yes.
Tell me what that means.
So when you're growing organs in the lab, one of the biggest challenges is creating the vasculature that you need to sustain the organ with blood, et cetera. So building that scaffolding is really difficult. And leaves have scaffolding very similar to the vasculature in a human heart, those veins that branch out from the large one in the middle. So they basically stripped a leaf of everything but the cellulose using detergent and then grew heart cells in it so that they could show that they would be able to pump fluid through it in the same way that you would want heart tissue to have fluid being blood pumping through
right.
it. So it's very early stages, but it's a really cool idea. And it's possible that other vegetation could be used for other kinds of organs.
So they just used the infrastructure and grew the cells on it.
Mm-hmm.
Was it pumping it? Was it beating it all?
Yeah, so this was just like the tissue itself.
Right.
Because the first step is making tissue that can stay alive. And then you can grow something that can actually beat.
Wow, something new for Valentine's Day. You have a leaf of my heart. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks for having
me. Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Since the late 1800s, dinosaurs have been grouped into two camps based on the shapes of their hips. You have the Saurischia and the Ornithischia. And the one is a lizard-hipped and the other is bird-hipped. And last week, researchers published a study in the journal Nature that would shake up those hip-based groupings. Joining me now to talk about the change and the possible effects of restructuring dinosaur genealogy is science writer Brian Switek. He writes the Late Lapse Log at Scientific American, and he's author of the book My Beloved Dinosaurs. He joins me by Skype. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back on.
Are your beloved dinosaurs being upset?
They seem okay with it. I mean, they've been dead for over 66 million years, but, it's a bit of a shakeup. I think it's more the paleontologists who might be a little bit more upset with this one.
No, I misspoke. It's my beloved Brontosaurus. Sorry.
Thank you.
Giving you all of those. So tell me, what is the shakeup actually happening? What's going on here?
All right, so this is a new family tree that was just published. And like you said in your intro, we've had the same organization for the two major branches of the dinosaur family tree since 1888. So now you have those two groupings sort of flipping a little bit. So you had in the Saurischia dinosaurs, you had the theropods, so things like Velociraptor and T-Rex. And you had the sauropods, things like Brontosaurus. And all the way on the other side of the family tree, in the Ornithischians, you had things like Triceratops and Stegosaurus and all those guys. Now, this new study says that the theropods and the Ornithischians are more closely related to each other than to the sauropods. pod dinosaur. So basically you have Tyrannosaurus and Triceratops being close relatives of each other, and then the dinosaurs like Brontosaurus all the way out on the other side of the family tree. So it's a bit of a switch in the arrangement that's traditionally been held.
Wow. So really, how big a switch is it? I mean, is small switch, big switch?
It's a pretty big switch because it brings up some big questions. For example, in dinosaurs like Tyrannosaurus and Brontosaurus, you have air sac systems, what was called pneumatic vertebrae, you know, these air sacs that invaded the bones and made them light while keeping them strong. If this new system is correct, that wasn't something that was inherited from a common ancestor. That was something that it had to evolve twice, or there's some other weird evolutionary arrangement. So this, you know, changes a little bit of what we think about how these animals evolved and how they acquired the traits that made them dinosaurs.
Well, I guess, as you're saying, the good thing here is that it gives us a better picture, right, of how it really works. But what's the bad thing about this then?
Well, I guess the bad thing is we don't really know whether to change the textbooks just yet. I mean, phylogenies come out almost, you know, every week, and this is an important one. It certainly seems to be a well-supported one, but it's a hypothesis like anything else, and there are some areas of dinosaur family history that we don't know a lot about yet. Like, for example, the earliest ornithischian dinosaurs, there's not really a good record of those. So there's the chance that, you know, someone's going to find a complete skeleton somewhere, and it's going to rearrange things all over again. It might go back to something traditional. It might support this new study. It might be something else. And that's just the nature of science. You know, it's not like a paper's, you know, divine fiat where it just becomes law and all the textbooks are changed. So it's an interesting idea, but we don't know yet whether it's going to stick.
One last question for you. Why are hips the key feature in this system?
Well, that's because when Harry Govier Seeley, who formed the system back in the late 1800s, the dinosaurs he had to work with were really these derived animals, these animals that had been dinosaurs, these lineage of dinosaurs have been around for a long time, that really had these hip shapes well established, and it was a really good way to tell the difference between the two. They had split so long ago that you could really tell, okay, which group was which on the basis of these hips. But now, as we're going further and further back into the earliest days of the dinosaurs, it's getting, you know, a little bit more confusing, or its similarities are, you know, crossing boundaries that we didn't think that they would cross. And that's actually another good thing, is that we're getting this better picture of the first days of the dinosaurs that we never really had until recently. So yeah, there's going to be a bit of turmoil and a bit of changing around, but it's really a sign of how much we're learning about that first 10 or so million years when dinosaurs really became what they were.
Fascinating. Brian, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Good
thank
luck
you.
On your book, My Beloved Brontosaurus. Brian Switek writes the The Laylaps blog at Scientific American, and author of My Beloved Brontosaurus. Stay with us. We'll be right back and talk about the physics behind disaster scenarios after this.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, science tries to tackle some of the most profound questions in life, like how did all the stuff in the universe form? Or if we build machines with advanced computing power, will they eventually become conscious? You can get lost in thought for hours turning over some of these ideas in your head. But some of the biggest what-if questions come from day-to-day observations, pure curiosity. Like, what would happen if you stuck your hand in a particle accelerator? You think, does that keep you up at night? Or if you dug a hole to China and jumped in, where would you come out and would you survive? These are some of the extreme ideas that my next guest explored and answered in the new book, And Then You're Dead. What really happens if you get swallowed by a whale or shot from a cannon or go barreling over a Niagara? He did the calculations and hopefully not too many experiments to figure it out. Paul Dougherty is co-author of And Then You're Dead. He's also senior staff scientist at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. If you have a what-if question, a disaster question you've been thinking about and you want Paul to try and work out the physics behind it, give us a call. 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be on Science Friday again.
It's always great to have you back. How do you weed through all the what-if questions? What makes a good what-if question? Something that you can really run the numbers for?
Or one that when you hear it, it causes you to smile and you think of all the really interesting stories you know about people that have actually done the body-on experiment, exploring this way to die.
Hey, have you actually figured out what happens if you get swallowed by a whale?
Well, yeah. So, in fact, when you bring up sperm whales, they cut them open and look at what's in their stomach. And you'll find a multi-100-pound squid eaten and swallowed by that sperm whale. So they're not going to have much trouble with you. Now, of course, the beaks of those squid irritate the innards of the sperm whale, and they cover them with spermatocete, which is this wax-like substance that eventually comes out of the sperm whale, floats around in the ocean, washes up on beaches, and becomes this really valuable ambergris. And so we're wondering, would your human bones be surrounded by this incredibly valuable perfume substance? And we think yes.
Are you ready to tackle questions from our listeners? Because they have a lot of them.
Oh, my word. Sure. Fire away.
Okay. Let's go to Salt Lake. Sean in Salt Lake, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey. Hi, Ira.
Hey there. Go ahead.
Okay, so I was wondering, if I was on Mars in my spacesuit and my helmet came off or something bad happened to my suit, what would happen? And how would that compare to what would happen, say, on the moon?
Okay.
Okay, so the atmosphere on Mars is 1/100th as thick as the atmosphere on the Earth. And it turns out that at that low pressure, if you had an open glass of water on Mars, it would boil. So eventually, the water in your body would boil. But it turns out, you know, that chemists, when they go to boil fluids, they throw in things called boiling beads. And they have little scratches on them, and it promotes the actual gentle beginning of boiling. But you don't have boiling beads inside your skin. So your helmet comes off. You've got maybe 15 seconds, and people have tested this, before the blood in your body bursts into boiling and you swell up. I think just like Arnold Schwarzenegger did in that movie once. I think they got that part right. Of course, then they restored the entire atmosphere of Mars in the next few seconds, and that's probably pushing the science a little bit far.
Get a lot of questions about space, stuff like that? You know,
because
we have a half a dozen on the board here that, you know, basically
the
same question.
I'm a planetary scientist. I'm the discoverer of the shape of the Martian snowflake. So I've actually done research on the Viking mission on Mars. So go ahead. Ask again.
Okay. You asked for it, as the old show used to say. Let's go to Clyde in Spokane. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, and glad to be here. My question is, what if we were in a submersible in the oceans of Europa? How deep could we go before the pressure is a problem, potentially fatal problem?
Oh, yeah. So we're going to have that ocean on Europa. It's the density of water. Now the gravity on Europa is a little bit less than the gravity on water, so you'll be able to go a little bit deeper. So we know that on Earth we can go to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. But the oceans on Europa are probably even deeper. So eventually, as you're going down in the oceans of Europa, the pressure will probably exceed the ability of any vessel we've ever built so far and crush you. And so it might be an interesting experience for the first few kilometers you're going down. You'd get to see what is it out there swimming in the oceans of Europa. But eventually, yep, the pressure's going to win. You're going to get crushed, even with the lower gravity.
I'm hoping they bring that fabled styrofoam cup down there. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. And just picture your brain as the styrofoam cup. So as your spacecraft submarine gets crushed, That's what happens to your skull and your brain, just like that styrofoam cup that squeezes down to tiny nothingness.
Now, I know in your book, and this is a great book, I'm talking to Paul Doherty, if you just joined us, author of Then You're Dead. Great title. We'll look at that in a second. There are questions you imagine that have actually happened. Someone did put their body into a particle accelerator?
That's right. Russian scientist by the name of Bogorsky was working on the U-70 particle accelerator in Russia, and it happened to turn on while he had his head in the way of the beam. So it not only went through his hand, it went through his head from the back of his head to the front. And he said he saw a flash the brightness of 1,000 suns. And they all thought he was going to die. I mean, he had this particle beam the diameter of a pencil lead go right through from the back to the front of his face. But it turned out, much to everybody's surprise, he survived the radiation. He actually went on and got his PhD.
Wow.
But it paralyzed the left side of his face. And it turns out, if you look at a picture of him now, the left side of his face is smooth and unlined and looked just like he did when he was a student, and the right side is all wrinkled like it should be at his age. So maybe if you really want the ultimate beauty treatment, you just stick your head in a particle accelerator and survive.
You do that.
No, I think I won't.
Here's a tweet from Cookie, who writes, "What would happen if I was taking the subway or driving across the Manhattan Bridge, which is here in Manhattan, and the bridge collapsed? Any chance of surviving?"
Not much. It turns out the Air Force has done lots of studies on people falling into things, so falling into water. So, for example, I'm from San Francisco, and if you fall off the Golden Gate Bridge, that's a couple hundred feet down to the water, your chances of surviving are just a few percent, because that water, it's, you know, it weighs 8 pounds per gallon, and when you hit it, your body's traveling over 60 miles an hour. So imagine what it would be like to be hit in the face by an 8-pound mass going 60 miles an hour or more. It's going to really hurt, maybe kill you.
Yeah.
But in fact, that plunge into the water, if you're out of the car, will almost certainly kill you. But in the car, maybe the airbag would inflate and save you from that collision with the water. So maybe there's a slightly better chance in the car. Of course, then you got to get out of the car.
Yeah, a little stunned by that. You figured out these numbers by using the Fermi problem solution. What is that?
So I was an undergraduate student at MIT, and Professor Tony French, day one of class, said, before you solve any physics problem numerically, you should estimate what the answer is and know what the answer is approximately before you do it. And he told us the story of Enrico Fermi, famous scientist, who once was asked, how many piano tuners are there in the city of Chicago? And he went through, you know, how many people are in Chicago, what fraction of them have pianos, how often do they need to be tuned, and he came up with a number. And then you could go do the hard work and check out in the Chicago phone book what the answer was. So, for example, in the book, we wondered about jumping in a hole to China and thinking about, well, wait a minute, what if that hole that goes through the earth has air in it? And you know, if you go up in a mountain, that the air gets less dense by a half every 15,000 feet. So that's the basic knowledge you need to be reversed as you go down in the hole. Every 15,000 feet you go down the hole, that's only 3 miles, you get air around you that's denser by a factor of 2. In 150,000 feet, that's 10 doublings, the air's going to be roughly the density of water. And you're going to stop.
Right.
You can't get through unless you evacuate the hole. That's the Fermi answer. You take that little knowledge about the atmosphere and you turn it on its head and use it to get an approximate answer. And then you publish it in a book. And every scientist in the world takes aim at you to show you how you're wrong.
That's
how science gets it right.
It's like my staff here. Our number 844-724-8255. Let's go to the phones to Beth in Baltimore, or Balmore, as they say there. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Ira. I'm a teacher, and my students are studying electromagnetic radiation right now, and they were wondering what would happen if all the electromagnetic radiation from the sun was able to reach us here on Earth.
Hmm.
Oh, boy. Well, it turns out there's ultraviolet C. So, of course, on Earth we get visible light, and we get ultraviolet A, B. And the ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B give us sunburns. But the upper atmosphere of the Earth stops the even more powerful ultraviolet C. And when that's used on Earth in hospitals, it's germicidal. That ultraviolet C kills cells. So if you're out in space and you get exposed to the sunlight, you probably get sunburned, or you get a dose of radiation that would cause a sunburn in about 15 seconds. So you better thank the atmosphere of Earth for stopping that ultraviolet that would get through. In fact, it's been estimated that our atmosphere is about sunblock 256. So if the ozone layer goes away, you're going to step outside without sunblock. You'll get sunburned in 15 seconds, which is not something good.
We also have the big belt, radiation belt, that sort of protects us from other kinds
of radiation. Particle radiation, the particles coming out of the sun that are gathered in by the Earth's magnetic field and deflected and captured in the radiation belts. So you don't want that either. And in fact, on the way to the moon, the astronauts blast through those radiation belts really quickly. First of all, you have to go fast to get away from the Earth to get to the moon, but you don't want to spend time in those radiation belts. And when we go to Mars, we're going to be traveling outside of the Earth's radiation protection field, the Earth's magnetic field. So the astronauts heading off to Mars are going to need protection in the spacecraft against the particle radiation of the sun.
Big problem. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Paul Doherty, co-author of the new book, And Then You're Dead. Did your publisher love that title? Everybody dies in these scenarios.
Yeah, we originally were going to call it something like gruesome, but we thought that was too gruesome, and we liked And Then You're Dead as a better answer. And we do have some people that survived, so that's always good.
Here's a tweet from Beakerhead, who writes, a person fave from the kids. If everyone jumped at the same time, would anything happen?
Well, you know, that's a classic problem, was that if you had everybody jump and you synchronized them, perhaps instead of even jumping at the same time, you had a wave. So it started in New York, and the people just, at the speed of the wave propagation, people would jump and add in their energy and make a focused beam of seismic energy to destroy things. But alas, as massive as the people are on Earth, we don't have nearly enough energy to make a seismically destructive wave.
Mm-hmm. What was your favorite, you know, it's your child, your book. What's your favorite fun thing in the book?
It was the one where the Japanese scientists investigated the slipperiness of banana peels. And they actually did this with banana peels and all other peels they could find. And they found out that banana peels were particularly slippery, that if you stepped on a banana peel, it had something called a coefficient of friction of 0.07. And that gave you a 90% chance of falling if you just hit a banana peel. And of course, human falling 6 feet up, your head hits the ground, that can crack your skull and lead to internal bleeding and kill you.
Wow.
So you got to watch out for those banana peels.
Yeah, I hate
but
the it when fact it happens.
The fact that they actually measured the coefficient of friction for banana peels, that's the science.
Well, let me ask you this question. You know, they have a slipperiness scale, right? With, I think, wet ice is the most slippery thing. Have they measured banana peels on that scale, or where it might
that
fit
is-
in?
That is the scale. That's the coefficient of friction. And rubber soles on wet ice is a friction coefficient of 0.15. And banana peels were a coefficient of friction of 0.07, which is slipperier than wet ice. with a rubber shoe. Of course, you have to actually specify the shoe you're wearing to get a correct scientific answer.
Well, before we get to the break of the meeting, let me get to a question I brought up during my introduction. What would happen if your airplane window suddenly popped off? Would your seatbelt help you stay inside, or would you be sucked out the window?
So if you're sitting right next to the window, we went out and looked out the fluid dynamic calculations about how fast the air is going to rush out the window if you're at 35,000 feet. And we found out that the initial wind would blow out that window at 300 miles an hour. That's the wind speed in the worst tornadoes. And that is enough to suck you out of your seatbelt and toward the window. Now, luckily, you are big enough that you're not going to fit through that airplane window. That's what's going to save you.
So you become the cork that saves everybody else's.
That's exactly right. And we found this case of a pilot who they misinstalled the pilot window, and it blew out of his jet, a British Airways jet. And even though he had his lap belt on, the 300-mile-an-hour burst of air shot him out the window. But his legs tangled in the controls, and a flight attendant who happened to be in the cockpit grabbed his legs and hung on for 18 minutes while the co-pilot got control of the plane.
That's a
brought him back down.
Great segue. I want everybody to hang on for the rest of our segment. Paul Doherty, author of And Then You're Dead. We have an excerpt for the book on our website at sciencefriday.com/dead. He'll be back after the break. More questions. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Paul Doherty, co-author of the new book, And Then You're Dead. He's also a senior staff scientist at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. Lots and lots of questions, Paul. A tweet came in, which I cannot ignore because I'm thinking people want to know. A tweet from Matthew says, I was wondering if I were naked in the International Space Station and I farted, would I be propelled?
I'm pretty much for sure you would. That's action and reaction at its finest. And if there were an ignition source, we know that the fart contains methane, which will ignite, and that would make a little explosion, might give you a little extra boost, like an afterburner.
We'll have to find out what official policy is about that. Let's go to the phones to Andrew in Sutton, Mass. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, go ahead.
I got to say, this is a topic I'm very enthusiastic about. My question is about electromagnetic pulse bombs, which are kind of a threat to the power grid, as we know. And my question is, since humans ourselves have so much electrical energy going on inside our bodies, what would happen if someone stood next to an EMP when it was set off?
In other words, the pulse itself. Okay, what would happen to a person? Okay.
So that's a really great question, and I'm not exactly sure. However, we'll take an actual case. Let's say you've got a lightning strike right next to you, and that's quite a dose of electromagnetic pulse. And unless that lightning actually goes through you and starts triggering off your neurons, maybe even erasing a little bit of your brainstem, you're probably okay. So I think... In fact, I think there was a Futurama episode where the robots on this planet were trying to kill the invading human, and they kept bombarding him with electricity and magnetism, and nothing happened. And the final solution was to run a stick through him. And the robots decided, boy, that's amazing. He could take the largest amount of electromagnetic pulse we could give him, and nothing happened. But he succumbed to a sharp stick. Anyway, I think that's the answer there.
Someone wants to know what happens if you drink a lot of Coke and then eat Mentos. That's a tweet from Aaron.
Oh, of course. Well, if you're a rat, you die because rats can't vomit. But thank goodness you're a person. And there are a couple openings that allow the gas buildup to escape. So I believe you might suffer some real problems with pain of the gas, but I think you won't die. Although in the last example in our book, we find out how many cookies can you eat before your stomach bursts? And where actually in the stomach does the bursting start?
Well,
and that will kill you.
Well, there's a good cliffhanger for everybody to get a copy of the new book, And Then You're Dead. Paul Daugherty, also a senior staff scientist at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. It's a lot of fun, the book, Paul. Good luck with it. It's a really interesting reading.
Thank you, Ira. It's been great to be on Science Friday.
You're welcome. We also, as I say, have an excerpt of the book up on our website at sciencefriday.com/dead. Asteroids slamming into Earth usually conjure up images of death and destruction, a cloud of dust snuffing out life around the globe. It is the stuff of Hollywood disaster movies. And sometimes actual asteroid impacts can cause real damage. The space rock that exploded over Russia in 2013 was estimated to have released 440 kilotons of energy. It exploded in the air, it blew out windows and injured people on the ground. But maybe asteroids are getting a bad rap. There's a scientist who has a different take on these impact events and is using, shall we say, an unconventional lab to test out one of his theories. He's recreated asteroid impacts using a really powerful sort of giant musket. You intrigued? Well, we sent producer Alexa Lim on a trip out to California to watch one of his experiments.
The first place I meet geologist Peter Schultz is at a gun range, a strange spot for a quiet conversation about science. But this isn't your usual gun range. There aren't any paper targets or pistols here. It's a high-tech lab run by the NASA Ames Research Center out in California. And the gun? Well, that's not usual either. It's bright orange, two stories high, and it fills up a garage that was once a workshop for the Apollo program. Peter and his crew crank the gun into position.
This section here, you put in a lot of gunpowder. It explodes. It takes a cylinder like this. The explosion will actually shove this down into a tapered tube. At the end of the tapered tube, it's got hydrogen gas, and that hydrogen gas expands very rapidly. And then that will carry the projectile down in the chamber.
That sounds like a bad idea.
The shot sounds pretty impressive, but it's what happens after that's important. First, there's an explosion of energy. That creates a curtain of dust and debris. And then there's the heat. Heat so intense it can melt soil, rocks, and anything nearby. And what happens next? Well, that's the question Peter's investigating, because under the right conditions, what can emerge from that molten chaos is a certain type of rock, known as impact glass. He shows me a sample of it.
When you look at this in detail, you'll see how it looks like a twisted and folded, like almost like molasses. Yeah, it looks like somebody did this in the kitchen. It's gorgeous.
And this gun range is Peter's own test kitchen. He wants to see if he can make this stuff himself. So he's going to shoot a pea-sized bullet made out of Pyrex at a sandpit at 11,000 miles per hour. That's 3 miles per second. It takes a while to load up a 20-foot gun, just about under an hour. While the crew runs safety checks, Peter fills me in on what set him off on his hunt for impact glass.
I've been interested in this stuff since third grade. I used to make models of the moon out of plaster. I would use different types of nail heads to simulate different types of craters. But there was the moon, kind of like a mirror of the Earth. But the Earth, where are all the craters on the Earth?
Isn't it kind of easy to find a big hole?
Wouldn't you think it'd be easy to find, right? But it's not just a road, it's filled in. So it's buried. Or you're seeing that offshore, where it wasn't offshore before, but it is now, because the oceans rose after the glacial periods, and they've eaten away the evidence.
So how do you find these craters that have been buried or washed away? You follow the glass. For example, take the Chicxulub meteorite. You know the one that smacked into the Yucatan and took out the dinosaurs? Peter says that impact glass from that collision has been found all the way in present-day Colorado. Piece together the trail of impact glass, and it could point to these hidden craters and help tell the story of these impact events. It was during this hunt for craters back in the early 90s that Peter got word of a geologist who was investigating a mysterious layer of rock in the Pampas region of Argentina.
My name is Marcelo Zárate, and I'm professor at the National University of La Pampa.
Marcelo is now a professor and researcher, but 20 years ago, he was a PhD student living near the coast of Argentina. He was studying a group of sea cliffs that contained rocks that looked volcanic, except there was just one problem.
The problem is that the nearest volcano was 800 kilometers away, and these pieces were big, 10 centimeters sometimes, even 15 centimeters long, big pieces to be far away from a volcano.
But Peter had a hunch. He thought these might be impact glass. So he flew to Argentina to meet up with Marcelo.
I was using my Fokker flyer miles just on this one lark, and I had no clue what I was about to find.
Peter and Marcelo started collecting samples of rocks from all over the area. They eventually went on to identify glass from 7 potential impact events. But early on, they stumbled onto something truly strange.
We saw some things that looked like imprints of grass, and we saw things that looked like maybe grass trapped inside.
They found little blades of grass inside these rocks, rocks that had been scorched into existence.
I started thinking, geez, this is really unusual. Well, maybe we should look at this material that looks like grass and look at it more carefully. This may be a place where you could hide past life inside.
Meteorite impacts can wipe out life in less than a second. But Peter thinks that impact glass may actually preserve life, like a time capsule. It can give a snapshot of what the world was like at that exact moment. The soils, the climate, and even life. Peter digs out a piece of impact glass from Argentina so I can look at it myself under the microscope. I imagined that it would be shiny and smooth, but this rock, it's dull and full of small holes.
And here, if you look inside, you can see that there's these striations.
Yeah, well, so there's darker material and then it's surrounded by lighter material.
That's grass.
How
That's
old grass. Is that
grass? This grass is 9 million years old.
I can see a single blade of grass. It looks like the outline of a frayed end of an old shoelace. And it's not an imprint. This is the grass itself, the cellular structure. It's a relic from our prehistoric past, before the Pampas region was the windblown plains it is today, even before humans evolved. And somehow, this single blade of grass survived the fire and brimstone of an asteroid impact. And now, 9 million years later, I'm here, staring directly at it. As I'm looking into this microscope, freaking out about how much history this ancient piece of grass holds, Peter hits me with another one of his ideas.
Why not look at this on Mars? If it happened on Earth in this environment, why not Mars?
Meteorites strike Mars and form impact glass there, too. Maybe a catalog of past life on the red planet is hiding inside these dull rocks, preserved and waiting for something or someone to pick it up. Peter, Marcelo, and their team published a study a few years ago describing that idea. And their theory on how a piece of grass can survive the extreme heat of an impact? Well, it's kind of like frying a French fry. When the grass is heated quickly at very high temperatures, the water and outer layers take up most of the heat and burn off. The inner section is shielded from that direct heat and can be left intact, trapped inside. That's the theory, at least. And that's why we're staring down the barrel of this two-story gun, to study how this process works. Peter and his grad student, Stephanie Quintana, are busy setting up the target. They smooth out the sandpit until it's perfectly even. He sprinkles on small pieces of pampas grass, like he's finishing off a birthday cake.
It kind of looks like miniature celery. And if all goes well, we'll see these pieces trapped inside the impact glass created by the energy of the impact.
How are you feeling?
Nervous.
Really? Why are you nervous?
It might not work. You're always worried. Will it work? Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes a gun fails. It's an experiment. Mm-hmm. So,
everyone crowds into the control room to watch the impact. Multiple cameras film the sandpit at 25,000 frames per second.
Ready lights are green. Paddles in.
Oh! We did damage. The shot worked. There's a small crater off to the side. I don't know what that's about.
5.28 kilometers per second.
Sweet! There it goes. There's a piece of glass. That's what we gotta go find.
Wow.
After a couple of persistent digs in the pit, Peter finally finds a few shards of freshly made impact glass. And under the microscope, I can see that outline of shoelace-like fibers of the trapped grass. The experiment worked. There are still big unanswered questions. How would this process scale up in the real world? Could this capture things like bacteria? And could this even happen in the Martian environment? Peter's idea that impact glass might preserve ancient life has been 20 years in the making. Decades of gathering clues, piecing together ideas, and exploring his hunches.
I realized when you get these little clues, these glimpses of things, you need to ask the next question. When you can take options and jump on a plane and go down and follow your nose, you do it.
and he may get one step closer to testing his idea outside of the lab and far beyond the plains of Argentina, because researchers have used data from a NASA orbiter to detect impact glass in craters on Mars. And if Peter's lucky, one of those craters could be the landing site for the Mars 2020 rover. Of course, he won't be able to cash in his frequent flyer miles for that trip. He'll just have to wait back on Earth with the rest of us to find out if his hunch is right. For Science Friday, I'm Alexa Lim.
That was Peter Schultz, a geologist and professor emeritus from Brown University. And Alexa is here to tell us about her trip. Sounds exciting. Sounds like fun.
Hey, Ira. Yeah, it was exciting. Well, actually, when you first walk up to it, it looks like, you know, a regular garage. They have the corrugated steel door.
Right.
So it looks like you're getting your oil changed. but then when you walk in, there's the giant gun.
Yeah. Let me just remind everybody, I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Writer from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Alexa about what her trip was like. So there's this giant, is lying flat? You said it was two stories long. It's flat?
It's lying flat when you first get in there, but then they can crank it up to different heights and different degrees, because the most common angle for an impact to come into the Earth is 45 degrees. But, you know, they're scientists, so they want different angles, so you can go down or up 15 degrees from there.
You know, we on our website, we actually have a video up there, a great video.
Right, yeah, we have. So this, we actually conducted the experiment, and this impact takes about an eighth of a second. So there's a lot of setup, but it creates this tiny explosion. And we actually have the video. It's slowed down. It's 25,000 frames per second. But you can see it. If you look close enough, you can see the fireball. And, you know, when you think of an impact, you probably think of a lot of chaos. But Peter, he's interested in the process that actually happens. Like a cone forms, and you can see the swirl of the debris and everything.
You know, I was listening to your story. He sounded excited himself when that thing shot off.
He's done this for, I don't know, 30 years. He's been the main guy at this gun, and he gets excited every time.
So he's going to keep doing this until when? And what's the... Until he figures out what's going on.
I mean, he just retired from Brown, but he's still working there. He's still doing research, and he really wants to understand just the process of this. He wants to understand maybe, like, this impact glass can either capture grass on the ground, or maybe it gets flung out and just kind of picks up stuff as it rolls around.
It's sort of a proof of concept that we could be looking, and when we go looking at asteroid remnants, we could find pieces of who knows what's in them.
It's possible. I mean, this is a pea shooter. He's shooting at, like, dinner-size plate targets. So, you know, how does this scale up? That's what he wants to know. He needs to know the process more.
Yeah. And so, it sounds like it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was really exciting.
Right.
And we also have a website that our digital producer, Daniel Peterschmidt, built out, and it's amazing. We have an animated version of this story. And like I said, you know, if you see the video, it's your moment of zen for the week.
It's hypnotizing. It's mesmerizing. This object is slamming into it at 3 miles a second, and it's up on our website at sciencefriday.com/the-long-shot. Thank you, Alexa.
You're welcome.
Alexa Lim. One last thing before we go. Today is the last day for Julie Liebach, who is our managing editor of our website. She had a big hand in the Long Shot web feature and all the content that you see online. We will miss Julie's talented writing, her humor, and her heartfelt stories about Florida. Good luck, Julie. We'll stay in touch, won't you? Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, Jack Horowitz, our engineer, is at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you want to write us a letter the old-fashioned classic way, you can. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. And actually, Science Friday all week long up on our website and our podcast and our Facebook page and our Twitter. We're there all the time. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.